Hey, my dear beloved friends out there in hyperspace. Thank you for tuning in. I've been promoting this particular show quite a lot as I've got on Dr. Brooks Agnew, who, how weird is this? I don't understand. This is my seriously kindred spirit. I mean, I read his stuff and go, whoa, could I have written that or what? And we somehow never crossed paths. But when I read on his website, warning, following these links may take you deep down a rabbit hole of mind expansion, I said, this is the man I want to talk to. And I was led to him because, as many of you know, I have longed to go into the center of the earth physically because I've been there astrally and attempted to do that years ago when there was an expedition planned in 2005 by a man named Stephen Curry, who I believe suddenly, for some reason, disappeared from planet Earth. We're going to talk about that all and more today with my renowned author, physicist, scientist, and over-the-top man, Dr. Brooks Agnew. Hi, Brooks. Thank you for being with me.
Hi, Patricia. Good to be here. Thanks for the intro.
Well, thank you for being all that you are and doing all that you are. Hey, where do we start? I mean, I'm very excited, as you know, by our exchanges that you are planning this physical entry into the middle of the Earth, and which we, of course, know isn't exactly middle because we both agree that the Earth is a torus-type structure, torus tube-type structure. So I would like you to just go for it and tell us all about the North Pole Inner Earth exploration that you've got planned and how that came about and how you're going to pull it off.
Well, I, like you, discovered the expedition that Stephen Curry had planned back in 2005, and they needed a team to put together a method of measuring the curvature of the Earth so that we could determine whether we were locating an oceanic depression or not. And we went through all the instruments that we could to determine that, and we came to the decision that a precision gyroscope was needed, so I started the hunt to put the gyroscope together. And in November of 2005, I met with Stephen Curry in Salt Lake City, and he was in good health and excited about the expedition. I think at that time he had, I don't know, 10 or 12 people signed up for it, and it takes 100 to make it go, but it was marching its way toward some level of funding. And a few months later, my first volume of The Ark of Millions of Years became a very unexpected national bestseller, which kind of launched me out into the publicity world, which I was not used to. And I ended up speaking at a conference up in Washington State at Trout Lake with James Gill and Kisetti Ranch, and had an experience up there that I'll just say I had a mighty download of information, which I wasn't used to and had to come to terms with. But that weekend, came back and discovered that Stephen Curry had passed away in just a few months from rapid onset brain cancer, so he was gone. So the board met and elected me to be the expedition leader, which I assumed the reins sometime in September, early October, and we proceeded to return all the money to the people that had already put money in, and clear Stephen Curry's accounts and made everything square, and he's in really good shape that way, his family is, and proceeded to start over again with the fundraising. And this time we approached it from a more scientific point of view, bringing in mainstream universities and looking for legitimate institutional or private investor funding to launch it, so that we didn't have essentially a boat full of rich tourists. We had a boat full of, you know, qualified experts, so that we could return with an answer that made sense to the rest of the world.
So, but qualified expert, does that include one over-enthusiastic psychic?
Yeah, I very well could. As I mentioned before, we have about 4,000 applicants for about 38 available spaces on the ship, and that's not too bad at odds. That's about one out of 100, or one, you know, that's just not that bad. And most of those applicants, I will say, won't qualify. They'll be either, you know, the wrong kind of, like, we're not looking for military types. We're looking for people that have, you know, abilities like yours. They also have to realize this is going to be pretty grueling seasickness for 15 days. So if they are prone to that, we don't want them to stay 15 days in the bathroom. They also are going to be on film, part of the almost reality show that's going to be filmed for 15 days on that. And there would also be some extreme weather conditions like cold and high winds and rain. And it will be crunching ice for 6 to 8 days. So it can be the kind of conditions that don't make it a pleasure cruise, I'll put it that way. So we're going to choose around 100 people to fill those 38 spots.
What do you mean you're going to choose 100 for 38? I'm not getting the math.
Well, sure. 100 goes into 38 evenly. I'll explain. We choose them about 7 months early before we go, 7 to 8 months early. During that time, some of them will have their lives changed. They'll get married, they'll have babies, they'll lose their jobs, they'll die. Believe me, I have interviewed 300 people for 10 spots and had to interview again to fill the last couple spots. So we'll choose 100, and then they'll have basically 7 to 8 months to get their lives in order. They got to get passports, they got to get insurance in place for themselves, make sure that they can get 15 days off, you know, those kinds of things. And I can just tell you from experience that over 50% of them will not be able to do that.
And you're considering this to be a 15-day adventure? You're going to get into the inner earth in 15 days?
It's 15 days to locate the opening. We're not going to sail a 450-foot-long 23,000-ton, 75,000-horsepower, nuclear-powered icebreaker inside the planet. It ain't happening. But we will find the opening, if it's there, and we'll explore it with a helicopter and with a smaller boat that's on the boat. And if something else happens, which is more the Indiana Jones aspect of it, then we'll take that as it comes. We'll have a 5-day option, so that if we get there and some amazing things are happening, we don't have to look down on our watch and say, well, time for us to go. We could stay for 5 more days and exercise that option.
The inevitable question comes because the scientific, almost military idea of time entertains me, because I would venture a guess that if you actually were able to locate this opening and able to get in, that time would simply dissolve and you might find yourself in a position where either you can't get back out or you might not want to. What are your feelings about that?
Well, yeah, we've run those feelings by the team as well. That's one of the reasons why we're not sailing this craft in there. We'll get as close as we can, you know, so that we don't jeopardize the assets of the shipping company and 150 crew members that might want to be home at the end of on the 16th day. This mission is really about contact with an opening into the inner earth to either prove or disprove the theory that planets form as hollow spheres from a geological point of view. There are also legends that go with this. The Tibetans have it, the Maya have it, the Egyptians have it, the Eskimos have it, the Hopi have it,
yes.
That there are, you know, perhaps, you know, trans-dimensional or ultra-terrestrial intelligences that live, you know, inside the planet. All of these civilizations have legends of shining beings or intelligences coming out of the planet and, you know, administering to them and then returning. Even Noah talks about it.
Yeah, and I want to get to that in a minute when we move into a discussion about Tibet, because it is my experience from a purely psychic point of view that there was one tunnel going through the base of Potalapana Palace right in, and that was sealed up when the Chinese closed off Tibet. Did you get any sense of that when you were there?
I didn't. You know, the Potala's was the tallest building in the world up to about 100 years ago. And as you know, you've been there a couple times, it's 11,500 feet. So it's not for the faint of heart as far as altitude. It takes some time, a couple of days or even a week to acclimate yourself to where you can climb the steps to get in the Patala. But once you're in there, you're right, the Chinese have it pretty much chained up, and there's the approved government tour for tourists. And I don't know why this happens to me, but, you know, while we were there, I just asked to have access into the lower areas of the Patala, which I was immediately refused, and my guide told me, don't ask again, or you're going to get us in trouble. And so we just kind of hung out, you know, just trying to stand there by the door and by the guard and think about it for a little bit. Where should we go? What should we do? Put our intention out there. And all of a sudden, the guard speaks to my guide in Chinese. You know what? I don't see any harm in this. There's only four of you. I'll unchain the door. So he unchains the door, and he lets us in and closes the door behind us, and it is essentially pitch black. It really takes some time for our eyes to get used to the fact that there's no light in this area. And so we started down a hallway, and I told the other three that were with me, which included my guide, and two other travelers that were with us in this particular 11-person group. So we walked down the hall, and we went down a spiral staircase, not round spiral, but square spiral. And the stairs were in a Fibonacci sequence, first one landing, and then three, and then five, and then eight, and 13, and finally we landed on the basement floor. When it stepped off on the basement floor, there's this huge, you know, 2-meter diameter swastika etched in the granite with a giant, maybe 120, 140 millimeter piece of turquoise in the middle of it. And I said, wow, this is really weird. What's a swastika doing down here? He said, no, you got to understand, this building was built in the 7th century. That isn't a swastika. That symbol goes way back before what we, in the latter days, assign that symbol to. And this one stands for the Milky Way galaxy. And so when our eyes started getting used to the light, we realized that there were these big tarps over the windows. And so we tried to kind of pull the tarps back and let a little bit of light down there so we could see what was there. And there in the middle of the floor was this 60-foot tall structure, which to me looked like a giant Tesla coil. And in the middle of it was this cocoon, this gold cocoon that had a body of a Panchen Lama interned in it. I sent you a photograph of that. And so I said, wow, what is that? And my guide says, well, that's a stupa. And he explained to me that that's what they intern the bodies of the Panchen Lamas, and they can travel, you know, through dimensions from there. And there was this huge four-dimensional stargate painted on the ceiling in a mandala form. And I said, no, I'll tell you what that is. What?
I said, that is so awesome that you got in there.
Well, it is. I didn't really think, you know, that it was all that special until after we got out of there. But this thing was a Tesla coil. I told my guide, I said, look, I can find the evidence on this, but what is this thing for? And he said, well, it's for transporting the spirit of the Lama through time. And I walked around it, and it was 4,500 pounds of gold, 10,000 pounds of gem, or 10,000 gems on it. You can see the inner part of that cocoon is lined with sapphires, all hand-laid sapphires. So there's a tremendous amount of natural resonant energy with this thing. And when you got to look up at the top, I said, you see these gold runners that are coming out at an angle? They're stylized lightning bolts. That's what this thing is. So when I got back to the States, I found an old photograph of one of Tesla's coils, and I overlaid them, and they matched perfectly. And I have it in my presentation. So the Tibetans either saw what Tesla saw and made it artistically, and Tesla made it out of wire and electricity, but it appears they both had the same vision, 1,200 years apart.
I'd like to introduce the idea that this same concept on my book, Atlantis Rising, the cover shows something that looks like a Tesla coil and a sphere, a crystal sphere sitting on top of it with a coil in it that looks like, it's shaped almost like a snake. But it's a gold coil, and the book describes how this was orichalcum, and used, they called it the Mind Light Generators in Atlantis. This is something that I had as a recall experience, and it fits the same description from what you're telling me. So it might
well,
be that this was just...
that they intern the body of a dead person in the cocoon, but what happens if a live person sits in that cocoon and meditates? You're exactly right. This thing might be some kind of, you know, mind amplifier.
Well, this is what the book, my book talks about, Mind Light Generators. It talked about how the energy of human thought was utilized to electrically or energetically illuminate the whole civilization, and not to mention time travel. So very interesting, this aspect that you're telling me about. I've got to look at the picture a little bit more. I think it's amazing that you were allowed to go down there, and I'm sure you asked yourself why, cosmically, I'm sure not only why the Chinese guards would let you, but what the cosmic purpose of it was. And do you think that you had something to bring forward to us from that visit?
Well, my purpose of going there was on a trek to follow all the legends that had anything to do with a hollow earth. And so the trek led me from Shasta to Mammoth Cave to, you know, different places where the legend has popped up here and there, to Egypt a couple times, and then to Tibet. And you know, it's infused in Tibetan Buddhism. All the symbolism, all the mandalas and everything tie into inner earth energy, and the fact that the humans, beings, the sentient beings alive on the earth, are integral to the grid that makes up the total earth. The earth isn't dead, it's alive. It's a different life form, but it's alive. And the fact that there are 7 billion sentient beings alive on the planet right now is no coincidence. We're getting ready for something grand.
Yes, we are. I think that we'll all agree to that, and it's nice to hear it presented as something grand and very positive.
Well, it could also be grand and terrible. I'm not exactly sure. I state both in the book because, you know, these methods of manifestation, of mind focus and even resonation, work both ways. They work for good or for ill. And it
sure
seems like, you know, wicked men or men that want to come to rise to great power and have great lust of the eye and pride of life and things like that seem to focus on it, realize it, and use it to get gain, which is corrupt. And most of the people, I would say 95% of the people on the earth, have no idea that these things are possible. But I will tell you this, something like 40 million or more people on this planet know about a hollow earth. And they have their ideas about it. Some of them are kind of really out there, like, you know, cities of gold and mythical beings that live there today with whom they channel. And I respect all that, but I'm a scientist. I'm looking for a stone. I'm looking for a bone. I'm looking for a photograph, you know, something that I can show the world. And maybe that's the whole mission of the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition, is to introduce the rest of the planet to the rest of the planet.
Yeah, I think also it's interesting to note that we've got a lot of information coming out now about inner Mars, and I'm sure you're aware of Andrew Bajago and the information that he brings through about the time travel CIA experimentation that he experienced as a young boy.
Yeah, Andy and I know each other very well. We've spent many days across the table from each other talking and reminiscing, and I have great respect for his story and for his perspective, and I think that it isn't just Earth that forms as a hollow sphere. I think the natural formation of a stable planet is as a hollow sphere.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about it, I was having a discussion with someone recently because my books also state that there are civilizations in so many planets. And I've gotten commentary like, that's so off the wall, Patricia. Where do you come up with these ideas? And I say, you know, how much less off the wall is it to think that a civilization of beings can survive on the surface of a sphere, on a round sphere, than it is to think that this same sphere could contain life? Why is it any stranger? it kind of stops them in their tracks. But I think that's
a really good perspective, because, you know, good planets are hard to come by.
You've got the embracing cup-like structure of a sphere that could contain life versus life clinging to the outer edge of this ball in space. And I'm no physicist, but it makes sense to me that it would, if I had my druthers, I'd probably go for the inner being safer, at least.
We already know from the Kepler mission that the sweet spot where water is in liquid form is very rare with respect to planets that we've been able to explore in our galaxy. So to have one where water is in liquid form and, a sun with the wavelength that we have, not a blue sun or a red sun, but one that puts out the right wavelength so that DNA can survive on the surface is really, really rare. The fact that we have about, 4 miles of usable atmosphere on the surface of our planet. Nobody lives pretty much above 20,000 feet or 22,000 feet on our planet. But inside the planet, there may be 1,000 miles of atmosphere, and it's probably that way on every planet. So it's probably much more common to live on the inside of a world than it is the outside of a world. And it's not so outlandish when we think that even in the United States, we only spend about 15% of our time outside. The rest of the time, we're inside a shelter of some kind.
That's very true. That is very, very valid. And we are inner dwellers, as you say, unfortunately. So all of the stuff that's going on in the night skies, for example, very few people see because they're all plugged into their houses and their TVs. And, I'm one of those people that sits out a lot and watches what's going on in the sky.
I sometimes look up on heavens above when the International Space Station is coming over. And whether I'm in a small town or a big city, I usually go out that night. And, 15, 20 minutes before I know it's going to come over, I ask people, have you ever seen the International Space Station go over? Well, no. I said, so you don't look up much, do you? And they say, well, is it hard to see? I said, well, why don't you look up? Because it's coming over in about 2 minutes. No way. No, yes, it is. Right over there. It's going to come from right at that point. And sure enough, here it comes. And they go, oh, my gosh, look at the size. I've never seen. Well, I said, well, it goes over 18 times a day. You know, you never look up and see it. You could see it during daylight. You know, this is going over your head or somewhere on the planet. It just has to be going over our town tonight. But it's been up there for years. There's a whole lot going on in our skies, and people don't know about it.
Yeah, in fact, I'm often confronted with people saying, if I want to be able to see, and of course referring to the psychic viewing, and I said, well, start looking. Look with your eyes. Stop worrying about seeing psychically, and take note with your beautiful eyes of what's around you. Recently, I brought a group of people on a sacred journey to Egypt, and we went. I'm really good at getting private time at these temples, so at 4 a.m, I had private access to Hatshepsut's temple in the Queen's Valley.
Yeah.
And after we did our ceremony, I told everyone to lie down and look up, and sure enough, I called out and said, please come. You give me so much, but please come for the others. Let them see you. Be seen. And zap, we immediately got UFO swirling around overhead. The important thing, the reason why I'm telling you this is having 50 people validate that we got contact response to the human outcry. So I asked, they came, and then someone said, well, could that be the space station or... are you sure it's not a satellite? And it made a 90-degree turn and went boop, and then made another 90-degree turn, and it continued on its trajectory across the sky. And I said, I don't think satellites do 90-degree turns. And then again, 2 minutes later, after it continued its way over and everybody was thrilled and exultation reigned, I said, it's not over yet. And bam, another one came and did somersaults and swirls around the sky and crossed the sky again. So I really recommend people get out there and start looking at everything that surrounds you. And you certainly are testimony to that with your comments about the space station.
Well, I, you know, I've always looked at things through the eyes of a scientist, and over the years, I've gotten better at being a scientist and not, you know, walking on both sides of the fence, so to speak. So a lot of people ask me, do I believe the Earth is hollow? Do I believe in UFOs? Do I believe in aliens? And I have to say, you know, unequivocally, belief really can't be part of, you know, my life, not professionally or personally. I'm more of a knower. I'm more of an explorer. And, you know, I'll believe based on the knowledge that I have. But once I turn that belief into knowledge, I'm going to stand on it and stretch even further. I'm not going to be, you know, stuck in a in some dogma believing. Because for me, it's only meant to be faith so that you can get a ways through the forest and make progress in your evolution.
Right. Well, there are phases. One is belief, one is faith, one is knowledge, and one is experience. And, you know, you can gather all the knowledge you want, but when you have the experience, the left brain gathering mind goes out the window and you are in the experience. And I, with that, I'd like you to tell us, how does the scientist talk of what happened at East SETI in Jane Gilliland's otherworldly ranch? What happened there? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I can talk about it. I mean, to have people really resonate with it, I guess think of the movie Contact, when L, you know, was raised this almost agnostic, you know, really rebellious kind of disbeliever in any higher authority or higher God because her father was taken from her. And so, you know, she's spends, you know, countless hours with headphones on looking for something, anything. And then toward the end of the movie, she has this experience in space. She has this vision. And just the look on her face when she sees what she sees, she realizes that she cannot reconcile this with anything that she has believed her whole life. So now she has experience that flies in the face of her belief. And the frustration right. with how to explain that comes out when she goes through the congressional hearings. Well, that's kind of the way I felt when I came back from ESETI. Here I was, you know, a scientist and an expert in instrumental analysis and taking measurements and proving and improving processes in many different kinds of manufacturing settings. And I have this measurement that I take not with an instrument, but with my body. And that really, it really woke me up. It really, it actually didn't wake me up, it reawakened me, because I think I had this when I was a young boy, and I just went to sleep, you know, with the teachings of teachers and parents and authority figures throughout your life. You put that stuff in a box because you can't make progress in the, quote, real world thinking those things. But it reawakened me, and allowed me to go home and return to who I was, and to put full time joy in my heart. And what happened was, I was contacted externally by a tremendously, I'm going to say, loving and uplifting energy. It started with sound, like a million angels singing all in harmony. Voices. I actually thought James Gilliland was playing some music outside, you know, in the house, but there was nothing. It was silent. This was all, you know, coming through the inside. And this vibratory connection to Mount Adams, and then this, at the end of the music, when it all died down, you know, the voice coming and saying, you know, because you are quick to forgive, you are forgiven. And then just the disconnection, and it was like, I don't know, 1,000 volts being taken off of you, and you get an arc at the end of it. That's what it was like. And I was able to see and hear and feel things that I had not felt in probably 45 years.
Wow. What do you think is going on there? You, from balancing the spiritual and the scientific sides of you? What do you understand is happening in that environment?
I think at one time they were one. I think that the spiritual and the scientific were one. And over time, what happened because of, I think, the greed and lust of men wanting to have power over other men, they separated the two. They said, okay, the scientific and empirical world is going to be over here, and then the spiritual world is going to be over here, and we're going to separate these two. And then we're going to use the spiritual world to strike fear in the hearts of men, and we're going to threaten them with eternal damnation and suffering if they don't do what we tell them to do. And that's where the schism occurred, and it has been that way ever since.
But what do you experience in that particular environment at Gilliland's? What is it with this place? I mean, why do you feel...
You never been there?
Well, no, not yet.
It is, I don't know, for lack of a better word, it's a vortex. It's a place where literally when you walk on the property, you can just take a deep sigh, a deep breath, and it's like all of the trappings of who you are in the outside world come off, and you become a real soul. And it's sometimes a crisis period for people when they come there because they haven't taken care of the soul part of them. They've only taken care of the outside trapping part. And when they get there, they kind of fall into crisis because they don't know who they are. But those of us that have glimpsed who we are and like it, when we go there, we can be who we are without fear. And it is a place of great, I would just say brotherhood and sisterhood, but really it goes beyond that. It's a kindred godship that goes on there where, we realize where we came from, why we're here, what we're doing here, what the purpose of our being here is, and why this time, and we're able to work with that.
And there are so many people that are struggling to find, to remember who they are and to find that purpose. And as we hit this arbitrary, I know that 2012, December 21st is an important date strictly, regardless of the calendars, the Mayan prophecies or whatever other prophecy is attached to that time. The fact that 7 billion people have an attitude about that date means it's an important date, regardless of the alignments and everything else. And as we approach it, more and more people are feeling an urgency to understand what they're doing here. And like you said, those of us who are at peace with that have an easier road than those of the people who are still struggling to understand that. But no doubt that this is a time of coming to terms with that for so many people on so many levels.
Well, I think there's three camps. I think some of them believe that it is an important date and something mighty is going to happen, but it's going to be cosmological. It's going to be a comet, an earthquake, a tidal wave, of atomic war, something like that. Others think that it's an important date and we see the grand separation of intention of two kinds of human beings. I guess I would call them dark hearts and those who vibrate at a higher level. They're able to understand higher things. And this goes to whether they're, an exploring Christian, a Muslim, or an agnostic. That struggling energy has a resonation. And then the third group is a group that thinks that none of this matters. The only thing that matters is how many toys I can stuff into my garage before I die, and how much of that process can I get somebody else to do for me.
Wow. What an empty thought that is. How many toys? The difference between men and boys is the size of their toys.
Yeah, well, we have a third class, and that is getting the other people, taxpayers, to give it to you free. So you don't have to work for it. You don't have to struggle for it. All you have to do is sit there and eat and drink until you get so fat and so drunk that you die.
Yeah. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm reminded of the Egyptian pharaohs with all of their wisdom and understanding of resurrection and their devotion to that aspect of their own immortality. They still didn't get it right, having to bring in the gold and kill the slaves, bring them in and fill the place with wine and beer.
And conquer other nations. They still had to go out and conquer other nations.
Yeah.
I think it's because the Egyptians were not the ones that built those edifices. They inherited them and they tried to understand them, but the pharaohs simply came to power because there are always men that come to power that way. But I don't think they had anything to do with the building of Giza.
No, neither do I. What is your opinion about Giza?
Giza existed at least 5,000 years and maybe 10,000 years before the Egyptians ever got there. It was used, retired, and abandoned millennia before they got there.
In fact, the going story by the archaeologists is that all of the other pyramids were attempts to learn how to build until finally they achieved mastery and built the Great Pyramid. And my understanding instead is that the Great Pyramid was the model and they kept trying to create something similar, but never
that
could.
That is my understanding as well. I mean, anybody that's been in it, if you've spent, you know, half a day in the King's Chamber or you've made your way to the pit beneath the pyramid and you've meditated on it at all, you realize almost instantly that this thing was there, sealed up, pure white limestone on the outside when the Egyptians got there, and their leaders said, wow, I want one of these of my own. Figure out how that thing is made. And so they just began to chip into the limestone and try to figure out how it was made. And when you go to Saqqara and you look at that, it is a stack of mud bricks compared to Giza. And when you go to Dendera, you can see the section that was built by the Hathors. It's easy to see. And then you can see what's been added on to it back in Roman times. It's a joke. It's a joke.
Yeah, it is. You know, the crypt, have you been in? Of course you have. The crypt in Dendera, have you been in it?
Yeah, I had the forethought to bring a wide-angle lens with me because I didn't realize that the crypt was only about a meter and a half wide. And to get back away from the wall that has the quote-unquote lotus flowers on it, the light bulbs that everybody is familiar with, you have to have a wide-angle lens to photograph it. So I got several dozen high-resolution photographs of that, and there's a lot more on that wall besides those light bulbs. It's an incredible lesson in ancient technology on those walls.
And some very particular graphics that don't correspond to anything else in Egyptian art, in Egyptian record.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting, too. That's a good point, Patricia, because, you know, down there, the colors survived. So not only do they have fairly simple electrical diagrams, but the two circuits are colored red and blue. And they still are to this day because they haven't been exposed to sunshine. The other thing that you notice at Dendera and also at Hatshepsut is that there are images of the Hathors they look like alien beings. They're basically a female face with cow ears. But you cannot find a replica statue of a Hathor anywhere in Egypt. If you do, it's going to have a cow's head. It doesn't have the woman's head like the Hathors have on the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So, what I'm trying to explain here is that the Egyptians, the people that occupied the Valley of Egyptus, have no clue who these beings were and how they worked and what their methods of mathematics and music and power were. They symbolize everything with a cow, and it's not.
That's right. But when you look at the many fabulous, even Hatshepsut Temple has that fabulous Hathor Temple and those beautiful faces, to not understand that these are depictions of another race, I find almost ludicrous.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. And especially when you hear, if you're there with other tour groups, there are a lot of them from France that are there too, and you listen to their explanation of what's going on there. It's also way off base. They're teaching a false history of what goes on there. And, you know, I think they snap a few pictures and they go home and say, wow, I went to Hatshepsut. I went to Dendera. I was at Abydos. But they have no clue what they're looking at, why it was built, what those things depict.
Well, that's right, because if the truth comes out, or at least is implied, they're going to have to rewrite all the history books. Look at Dr. Osmaninov. So, I can't ever say his name right. Sam
Osmanagic.
Thank you. Have you been out there in the Bosnian Pyramid?
No, I've communicated with him several times, and I've wanted to go. I spoke with him years ago before he actually broke into the pyramid. He was convinced it was a pyramid, and he was being excoriated by local archaeologists, you know, into saying that this guy was a kook and there was no pyramid there, it was just a mountain and blah, blah, blah. And now, of course, everybody knows the truth, and it's pretty amazing. But so I have not spoken with him in a couple of years.
Well, I met with him some months ago, and he gave me an actual video interview talking about the pyramid structures. There now have five pyramids there, not unlike the Pyramid Valley in Mexico. And he said that the Egyptian archaeologists were all over him because they said, we can't change the history. The history hasn't been established. We can't let it move forward.
And that's right.
Hate to be a bad sport, but this is history, and you're going to have to rewrite it because these pyramids are older and bigger, read my lips, than the Great Pyramid of Egypt.
yeah, exactly.
It's extraordinarily big.
Yeah, the one in, I think it's Chichen Itza, is large enough to put all three of the pyramids in Egypt inside of it.
Chichen Itza? Are you sure you're not talking about the Pyramid of the Sun in
Teotihuacan?
Yeah.
Well,
I don't think the Chichen Itza pyramid is bigger than the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, I haven't been there yet. I'm going in December, but I've been to Teotihuacan, and the difference is that those pyramids in Teotihuacan are made of mortar and lots of little volcanic chips, and they're laid, you know, layer by layer. It's still pretty fantastic when you get up on top of there and you look out and see that there's not just two pyramids, there's about 200 pyramids, and they haven't been uncovered yet. You could see them from on top of the Temple of the Sun or the Temple of the Moon.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've been there too. I don't know if I can say that I saw 200 pyramids, but it was definitely awe-inspiring. But nothing today can come close to what you experience when you're inside the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, when you're in there and you see this Sudanese black granite and realize that these things are well over 250 feet up in the air and have been laid to span as a ceiling and walls and a floor, and you really can't fit even a piece of paper between them.
That's right.
I spoke with Robert Balval about this, and I don't understand everything that his theories are, but he's an engineer, and so am I, and we've done some pretty large projects. And I said, Robert, did they have a standardized system of measurement back then where they could send a measurement to Sudan 1,000 miles away and have these stones made and have them shipped here and have them fit? He said, no. I said, did they have a way to transport a 35-ton granite block from Sudan to here? He said, no. So I'm blown away just at the scope of the engineering. And even if you took modern tools, I suppose you could build the pyramids. It could be done. It would take a couple of cranes because of the span that you have to reach out over, but it could be done. But back then, without wheels, without ropes, there's no way.
No, this is similar to the example I made about why is it any harder to believe in the life inside the sphere than it is to clinging to the outside. So it is the same. Why is it any harder to believe that technology included understanding how to levitate the stones or reach resonance with the matter and just create non-gravity or whatever versus 7 million slaves trying to schlep these monstrous stones?
Yeah, exactly.
from
Occam's razor. You remove all the things that don't make sense, the thing that's left has to be the truth.
Right. Well, the great thing is that this is such a time of discovery. So many things are being uncovered, even physically as well as mentally. And it seems every day we're getting new discoveries all over the planet. And I'm sure that you, as a physicist and a scientist, can embrace that. Like you said, I'm looking for the stone. I'm looking for the factual aspect. And yet you're such a spiritual guy.
Well, I appreciate that. I realize that there's only 100 spaces on this boat. We've got 62 of them, you know, filled now, 38 to go. And we have 40 million people that we know of because of all the pilot film showings that we've had and emails and radio interviews that we've done that know about and want to go. And so we're going to be broadcasting live from the ship all 15 days, 24 hours a day, and people can log on and watch what's going on, like, you know, some seagoing reality program.
Wow. I want to be on that boat.
I hear you.
This is part of it.
This is part of it, you know, this energy, this intention, it all goes into the equation.
Yep. I have such a kinship with you, Dr. Brooks Agnew.
Well, and, you know, you should do something about that.
I'll tell you what, back when Stephen was promoting that thing, my partner said it was like $32,000 a person. And I said, okay, that kind of money is Twilight Zone for me. And my partner, Franco, said, we'll find it. I said, $32,000 to venture out on a ship? He said, we'll find it if you need to go. I said, well, that would be 64. He said, no. We'll find it for you. That would be one in the family. Is that the same cost it would be this year, this time around?
No. There's no cost. Because we realize that the revenue model has to cover the cost of the ship or it can't be done. And here's why. Because this kind of thing has to arrive with the right, and I'm going to use a scientific term here that doesn't make a lot of sense for me, but it will. The ship has to be of the right consciousness, because if it isn't, it's just going to be a boat on the water. We're going to see whales and ice, and that's it. But if we meet the requirements.
Can I laugh and interrupt you because of the original statement that I'm a scientist and I have to have the credible, and then here comes this beautiful language.
No, Patricia. It fits, and here's why it fits, because for every experiment, there are conditions for the data to be collected. If you have to stand on your right foot eating a ham sandwich with your left hand over your right eye, those are the conditions that have to be done in order to gather the data for the experiment. That's what you do. And so if you have to put a ship, a consciousness signature, 1,000 miles from the next, you know, flashlight in the middle of the ocean in order to create a signature to open a gateway to even access this data, then that's what we're going to do. I can't not meet the conditions of the experiment. If I meet all those conditions and it doesn't open, then I have proven the hypothesis that Earth is exactly the way our classrooms have been teaching it for 200 years, that we live on a giant molten ball in space, and we live on plates that float around on it like cornflakes in a bowl of milk. Now, that makes complete sense to the entire geological community. We're going to try to prove that's true. And if we can't, then Earth is hollow.
Well, you've got the factor of the consciousness of the explorers involved that could determine whether or not that portal opens or not.
Yes, and because of the legend that there may be ultra-terrestrials or historical civilizations that retreated into the inner Earth, or even extraterrestrials that reside in a place on Earth where humans have never been, then you want to make a signal, I'm going to say a welcome mat, so they can come and contact us. And when they do, 40 million people that are tuned in online will get to see it at the same time, and Earth will change.
I so want to be part of that journey. Let's make it happen.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Patricia.
Let's make it happen. I'm a can-do person. Like I told you, they call me the female Indiana Jones. And I have done not quite as many, quite as utterly to the ends of the earth things, but close enough that I think I can manage this. Yes, I can.
You're good with a bullwhip, or you wear the hat, or you're afraid of snakes?
No, let's get away from the bullwhip idea so we don't, get
off. Oh, okay. You mean you have the heart of an explorer.
I am a very, very, very powerful manifester. That I can tell you.
Good. And that's what we need. We'll put you on the front of the boat and say, Patricia, manifest.
Can I do it from the back of the boat? I will do whatever it takes to be part of that. Maybe that is really the hour of awakening that we are so eagerly awaiting as we watch this tiny blue ball go through its gyrations. And I'd like to be part of it. So let's make that happen. Brooks Agnew.
Well, I am one of the decision makers, to be sure. And I now have sampled your intention. So it goes into the equation.
Okay, good. I'll send it out to the universe, too. And I know everybody that's listening is rooting for me because my, following listeners know that I am a dedicated warrior for spirit on this planet. We have now 4 minutes left, hard to believe, of your hour with me. And I would like to start by, before we go into the thank yous, I want to be able to tell everyone how to reach you, how to find more about your other works, your books, etc. So since you know that better than I, would you please announce any information we can give people on how to reach you? I know that you're speaking at the Pythagoras Conference, for example. Give us a quick rundown, please.
Pythagoras Conference in October. That's at, in southern Indiana. So if you don't have a passport, you can make it. Also at the Maya 2012 conference in Chichen Itza on December 21st, 2012. That's, I'm really looking forward to that one. Amsterdam in November, Phoenix in August. If you want to know more, you can go to the official website for the expedition, which is the abbreviation of North Pole Inner Earth Expedition, NPIEE.org. If you forget that, just put in Hollow Earth in Google and it'll come up. There is a form under the contact tab. You can fill it out and your name will be in our database as an applicant for the voyage. If you want to know more about the books and where I'm going to be appearing and whether I can appear at your place, go to xsquaredradio.com. I'm also on the BBS Radio Network with Patricia. And I keep everything posted there, all my most recent interviews, contact information, and the link to all the books. My latest is Alienated Nation, which is a call to action for a constitutional convention, state-driven, as outlined in Article 5 of the Constitution.
You do great work. When are you going to be in November? When will you be in Amsterdam? One more time.
I think it's the 11th through the 14th. I'll post it on X Squared Radio, and the one in August is in Phoenix.
Well, so. I'm hoping to come and see you in Amsterdam, but I think I'm going to be in Russia teaching then. But we will see. At any rate, if I don't see you in Amsterdam, I'll see you at the North Pole.
Shall be done.
All right. People, please help send me that energy and help manifest that so that I can be there in such a momentous experience in body, which is going to be a phenomenal, phenomenal experience. Dr. Brooks Agnew, you are a true Renaissance man. I honor you and all the great work you do, and I thank you from the heart for coming on my show, and I hope that our contact has just begun.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. An hour goes so fast.
Yes, you'll have to come back on. Definitely come back.
Anytime.
All righty. Okay, everyone, you've been listening to the amazing Dr. Brooks Agnew. All of his work is just, he's all over the place, a kindred spirit touching upon all the greatness of the universe, the universe within us, understanding that it's all one, one, one. And with that, I leave you for today. By the way, I'll be leaving for England now in the next few days, leaving the sweltering heat in Rome, and on my way to the sacred journey, to the crop circles and the sacred sites that I do every year. So I will be talking to you next from there. And I ask you to remember that you are a spark of source. Remember that power, that light, that flame. You came in here knowing what you're going to do, and get on with it. And with that, I send you all my love, and I look forward to speaking again with you in 2 weeks. When I'll announce soon who my guest will be. Thanks again to the wonderful Brooks Agnew. Thank you all for tuning in and for all the light you are. This is Patricia signing out. Beyond the Matrix, soaring with the free thought zone, the eagles, the love, the light, freedom. Be blessed. Good night.